Hello and welcome to another edition of Sublime Insights. I'm Gareth Westwood, Head of Global Intelligence, and on today's episode, Aidan Mordecai will take us through the run-up to the Thailand elections, Edie Lipton will be discussing recent protests in Kenya, and Conrad Pietraitis will give us his take on peace in Colombia. As ever, please do remember to like and subscribe. Okay, Aidan, welcome to the podcast for the first time.
Thank you very much.
Now, I know your desk has been reporting on the upcoming Thai elections that I believe are mid-May, 14th, something we're keeping a keen eye on. How do you see it panning out? What's the most likely outcome at the moment as far as you're concerned?
Well, given that the election infrastructure, institutions and constitution, etc., has essentially written by the military junta since the coup in 2014. The ruling government at the moment, which is a coalition of military-aligned parties, or largely military-aligned parties, has got a big advantage, particularly given that the prime minister is elected not by just by the 500 House of Representatives members, which will be elected on May the 14th, but also with the help of 250 Senate members. And all those members were appointed by the military. So it gives their parties a big advantage, even though, you know, they're not very popular. You know, they haven't been a very popular government. Mm. And even though there's been some splits in the ruling military-aligned parties.
So let me get this straight. So you got the elected lower house, but the upper house, who are appointed by the military, actually appoint the prime minister, who's head of the elected.
They have each member of the Senate has an equal say as each member of the House of Representatives.
And they're not elected, they're appointed.
Yeah, they have been appointed.
So a huge advantage for for the military junta then. Mm-hmm. So what would have to happen for the military aligned parties coalition not to succeed in the next election?
Well, the party that was, you know, is very likely to get the most votes, at least from the public, is the Pheu Thai party, which is the third iteration of the party founded by Thaksin Shinawatra, who is currently on exile. And they've, ever since they were founded more than 20 years ago now, they've quite comfortably won most elections, and that's expected this time. They would really need a landslide to be able to govern without military parties.
Landslide. How many are we talking ratio?
Either them alone, or more likely them and maybe some opposition parties that are more closely aligned with them would need about 375 seats without the need or help from any of the military aligned parties or the Senate.
Over two thirds.
Yeah.
Okay. Is that likely?
They are very far ahead in the polls, but the polls aren't always very accurate in Thailand. And as I said before, the whole environment is very tilted towards the military. So I see it as quite an unlikely scenario. I think it's more likely that even, it's possible that the Pheu Thai party maybe will make an unprecedented sort of coalition with a ruling military party, possibly the ruling party now led by the Deputy Prime Minister, Pravit Wong Suwan, who was one of the coup leaders.
Okay, so in the run-up then to the election, have we been seeing much in the way of unrest, or is it quite controlled? Because obviously the military junta kind of run things over there. What have we been seeing?
Not too much anti-government protests. You know, rallies, political rallies have been well attended, but they've generally been quite peaceful. We had the largest protest since the coup in around 2020, 2021, led by students, but the military really cracked down on that, particularly away from the protests with the laissez majeste law, which was very broadly applied and put a lot of pressure on the young protest leaders. And it's been a big deterrent for any mass movements. So instead, we've seen some smaller, more impromptu protests in the city, sometimes calling for reforms to the laissez majeste law or the monarchy itself, which have been cracked down quite quickly.
So, seemingly then, not too tumultuous, quite a tight hold on the protests. Mm-hmm. But I guess going forward, we can say that the current administration doesn't have the best record in terms of against repression, human rights. I mean, do you see any risks for organizations going forward should the military junta continue to
That it does depend on what sector your perspective is from. From an NGO's perspective, it's difficult, and it's increasingly difficult. You not just deal with crackdowns on freedom of speech, you're probably dealing with surveillance and monitoring from the authorities. Journalists as well, particularly if you're covering the government, the military-aligned government. But from the other hand, the military government, the military-aligned governments still want investment. They still want a lot of trade. They want to develop Thailand. They want to attract investment, particularly to the East Economic Corridor, going from Bangkok to the Gulf of Thailand. And so they'll want to try and create a stable investment climate, but it won't be equal for all organizations.
And of course, military-aligned government, not military junta. Correct myself there, because they're not a military junta anymore. They're not called that anymore. Well, that was really insightful and great implications there for businesses going forward. So thank you so much, and we look forward to welcoming you again.
Thank you very much.
Well, E, it's great to welcome you back on the podcast. It's been a few weeks. We're going to talk about Kenya today. It will be very important to a lot of our listeners and our clients. Now, we had an election recently in the last year or so. I know, things have been quite stable there, but we've been seeing protests of late. And I'd like just for you to take us through what we've been seeing over the last few weeks.
Yeah, absolutely. So over March, we saw Raila Odinga, who is the opposition party leader and the runner-up in last year's election, call for bi-weekly protests nationwide over the cost of living crisis and calling for the resignation of President William Ruto. So we saw protests in Nairobi, the western city of Kisumu as well, where we saw security forces fire tear gas, killing one protester, injuring many others, and that kind of drove an impetus of more support for the protests going forward.
And they've stopped recently, haven't they? But your desk seems to think they might resume. Can you just take us through that?
Yeah, so on the 2nd of April, Odinga suspended the call for protests whilst he engaged in talks with President Ruto, who agreed to talk to him about some of the demands that he came up with. Some of them were over the cost of living. Some of them were over more contentious issues to do with forming a political alliance.
So he's seemingly, call me sceptical, but trying to get a bit more power here on the back of, it's a genuine cost of living concern. Is the current administration going to give concessions and give him some of this power he wants? Or?
So they've agreed to a bipartisan reform of the election committee and is unlikely to reintroduce some of the subsidies that they cut earlier last year, which was a key demand of the IMF to secure some funding. So it's likely that while the protests have stopped in the short term, when Ruto fails to meet these demands that Odinga has come up with, they're likely to resume again.
And have these been violent? I mean, what's the situation been like on the ground in the vicinity of these protests?
So in Nairobi, we saw protesters target government officers, and we saw security forces fire tear gas at them. We saw the same in the Kibera slum in Nairobi as well. And we saw clashes with security forces and protesters in other cities like Migori and Kitale as well. And we saw protesters also committing vandalism, looting, roadblocks erected throughout the cities as well. So they caused a significant amount of disruption whilst they were going on.
Absolutely. So it sounds like quite high risk for bystanders, travellers, supply chain.
Yeah,
getting to from the office and even office buildings. I guess the graffiti wasn't targeted just at government buildings. It was pretty sporadic, was it?
It was, yeah. It was. It kind of elevates all risks to assets in the vicinity of those government offices.
And given that this will now be a second go, we assume that the protests will resume and he may at some stage come back with the same demands. Do we think that the protests will be even more intense this time around? Will he call for more violence, for example?
I think they will be violent again, particularly as tensions with the security forces are already elevated following the kind of more violent tactics they used during the last protesters. When we had that protester killed in March, that significantly elevated public anger. So it's likely that when they do get called again, they will see the same levels of violence there.
So, I mean, the cost of the living crisis isn't going away anytime soon. And seemingly, you know, this political power struggle isn't going away anytime soon. What do you see for the medium term? Do you see this ending at all in the next 3-6 months, or will this just be a continuous cycle?
So we're seeing at the moment that the economy in 2023 is likely to remain subdued. That's likely to sustain high levels of unrest. And these high food and fuel prices also come at a time when the Horn of Africa is facing its 6th failed rainy season. So that's likely to undermine government efforts to bolster food security, driving higher levels of unrest there.
Thank you so much for talking to us again, and we look forward to welcoming you back to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Conrad, welcome back to the podcast. So been reading a lot of reporting from the LATAM desk. Quite a few attacks recently from the ELN group I've been seeing. But I thought these guys were in peace talks with the government. So maybe you can square that circle for me and put us in the picture of what's going on there.
Yeah, sure thing. So yes, technically the ELN, the guerrilla, is in peace talks right now with the Colombian government. The ELN guerrilla being the largest guerrilla right now in Colombia after the FARC demobilized in 2016. The problem is that the ELN guerrilla, although we coin and we still call them a single guerrilla, they're very fragmented. And the structure, the way the guerrilla operates, while there is a figurative head and while there are supposed to be some ranks, that is not as rigid as it would seem. So there's a lot of disparity between some guerrilla fronts, especially the ones that operate in Venezuela or the ones that operate near the Ecuadorian border, and their power to weigh influence on other fronts that may be wanting to demobilize faster than the other ones. That's the main issue right now. So if you see where the attacks are located, the vast majority of them are attacks where the Venezuelan front. So you'll see a lot of attacks around Arauca, Arauquita, a lot of attacks around the Caño Limón, Coveñas. Those are the vast majority of attacks we've been seeing nowadays.
And this disconnect, how is it being addressed within ELN? You know, is there a hotline from the leadership to these different fronts, or are they truly autonomous and not able to be controlled whatsoever by, you know, their administration, their leadership?
Yeah, so the ELN, the higher-ups tend to downplay the fact that they can't control a lot of their subordinates. So that's one issue that they will likely continue to do. And then when there are some differences between those ranks, what they tend to say is that, well, the Eastern Front or X amount of dissident fronts are very much interested in a separate peace, or they're interested in getting the best deal possible. So they try to influence the negotiations that way. The truth of the matter is that there's a wide gulf between a lot of these leaders. And a lot of leaders are, to put it bluntly, old, wanting to retire and have secured pension pots for drug dealing or extortion or kidnapping for X amount of years already. And they want to probably get out of the business, while there's a lot of people coming up around 30, 40 years old that are securing that pension pot for themselves and do want to continue the fight.
So just for our listeners and viewers who haven't been reading your reporting, what do they want? What are they fighting for? And who are they targeting to achieve their aims?
Yeah. So the wider structure of the ELN, it's a political association. They're fighting for political gains. Rural representation mostly. That was the original aim of the guerrilla 50, 60 years ago. that has shifted. The guerrillas mostly finance out of drug trafficking, extortion, kidnapping, and general crime and dealings, especially with the Venezuelan government right now. What they're trying to basically do is a rehash of the 2016 FARC peace agreements. So more or less, general demobilization, a large pardon that will include some caveats here and there. You know, some victims will get representations. There will be some judicial inquiries into misconduct by authorities, and one or two seats in the Senate. So for the more or less for the most senior members to maintain that cloak or that appearance of political influence. That's more or less what they're fighting for right now. What a lot of people, or what the dissident fronts would like, is a widespread amnesty. Widespread amnesty and more or less little to no security force involvement in the demobilization process. So in other words, they could secure the best of both worlds. They can retire whenever they want to retire with their amnesty, and they can continue financing narcotics operations in the near term.
So with this disconnect, you know, yeah, seemingly the attacks ongoing, as we've seen in the daily reporting, where do you see the peace process going in the short to medium term?
So this isn't the first time the government has attempted to strike a deal with the ELN. President Duque, the previous president, famously gave it a go. And then the Eastern Front, you could argue in a bid to destabilize the wider negotiations, put a bomb in Bogota, in a police facility, killed 20 cadets. That completely blew up the process. That will probably happen again. It might not be that exact same scenario, but as we get closer to a tangible deal, there's no evidence to suggest that dissident fronts are less dissident or would like to amend their political or their position towards the peace process. So that trend of attacks against security forces will likely continue.
And the attacks are primarily against security and government, yeah, forces. But I mean, you know, given the scale of them and the sporadic nature of them, clear bystander risks, what would you say are the key risks for organizations operating in that jurisdiction going forward in light of these attacks and the situation?
So the vast majority, as you pointed out correctly, vast majority of targets are security forces. But anybody representing any multinational will become a target. There's a long history of the guerrilla going out and targeting oil engineers, mining engineers.
For money?
Yeah, mostly for money, mostly kidnapped for ransoms. Although from time to time, if you get kidnappings at a strategic point in time, it's political leverage that has also happened. The FARC was very good at that, carrying out targeted kidnappings for political leverage. So anybody doing business, mining, oil and gas, especially near the border areas of Venezuela and Ecuador, will be at a higher risk, for sure.
So really complex threat environment. And in the short term, you don't see any rapprochement with the leadership and the government actually mitigating that threat on the border region. So you see that continuing into 2023?
Yeah. Our base case scenario is basically there will be a political rapprochement. The government has invested too much political capital for this negotiation to follow down from night to day, regardless of how many attacks or little minor attacks might happen by dissident fronts. If there is a big attack, then that might destabilize the entire peace process. But just given the amount of political capital both the senior leaders of the ELN and the government has put forward, we suspect there to be a tacit pact or peace deal in the next 12 to 24 months. That said, very much like the FARC, very much like the paramilitary demobilizations in the early 2000s, large dissident groups will remain active.
So I guess so long as money and opportunities in play, we can expect to see continuation of these attacks, kidnappings, and general criminality. And I know it's something we keep a close eye on here at Civiline. We do track these attacks, so I guess the best advice is to just keep up to date with what's going on and look out for the risks as they appear. However, for now, thanks for updating us on the situation. Really fascinating stuff, and we look forward to further reporting and indeed seeing you again on the podcast.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for another episode of Civiline Insights. A big thank you to Aidan, Edie and Conrad. And of course, thanks to you for tuning in and listening or watching. Do remember to like and subscribe. And we look forward to welcoming you to the next episode.